Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Moeller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Moeller Program, broadcasting you live today from Louisville, Kentucky. We're going to be talking today about an issue that was in the news and has not so recently been in the news, but ought to be back. And it's a topic that's going to, I think, be an issue of continuing reflection for the American people. It has to do with the meaning of Brokeback Mountain. And just in case you think just about everything's been said about that, the New Republic today is out with an essay. The essay is by Christopher Orr. It's entitled Masculinity in Brokeback Mountain. And Mr. Orr makes some amazing statements about what he sees as the loss of the opportunity for male friendships in America. And I'm going to agree with him in part, but I'm going to have to disagree with his major point. And I'm going to tell you why in just a few minutes. I think this will be an interesting conversation as we look back on the meaning of this movie that many people saw as a landmark, a groundbreaking event in America's cultural history. We're going to be talking about what it means and why, and in particular, what it means about the future of male friendships. This is the big issue. The future of male friendships. Because there are those who, like Mr. Orr, are now arguing that what's happened is that people with sexual hang-ups are now the only ones who are concerned about such questions as to whether two men will be having sex or not. Otherwise, it really doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter, Mr. Orr says. I'm going to argue that it does matter, and we all know that it does matter, and it's a good thing that it does matter. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. First, a review of some issues in the news. I want to go back to last Sunday. Resurrection Day in the Christian calendar, at least for most churches, and Easter, as it's most often called out there in the culture. And there were a couple of things that came up. You know, leading up to Easter, we were talking about the meaning of the resurrection of Christ and its centrality to the Christian faith. But a couple of things have come up, even in the last couple of days, that have caught my attention. And at my website, between Saturday and now, I posted some articles on some of these things. First of all, the Right Reverend N.T. Wright, who is the Bishop of Durham in Great Britain. The Anglican there, Bishop of Durham, or the major roles in the Church of England, he said something in an interview with an Australian newspaper that really caught my attention. And this is what he says. I want to quote from him here. Marcus Borg really does not believe Jesus Christ was bodily raised from the dead, but I know Marcus well. He loves Jesus and believes in him passionately. The philosophical and cultural world he has lived in has made it very, very difficult for him to believe in the bodily resurrection. I actually think that's a major problem, and it affects most of whatever else he does, and I think it means that he has all sorts of flaws as a teacher, but I don't want to say he isn't a Christian. I do think, however, that churches that lose their grip on the bodily resurrection are in deep trouble, and that for healthy Christian life individually and corporately, belief in the bodily resurrection is foundational. End quote. Now, on the one hand, I'm very thankful for N.T. Wright in this regard. One of his predecessors as the Bishop of Durham, a man by the name of Daniel Jenkins, he actually denied the resurrection of Christ, David Jenkins, that is, and Bishop Jenkins preached a sermon in which he very clearly denied the physical bodily nature, the historical nature of the resurrection of Christ. And it was not long after that, by the way, that lightning struck the cathedral and did massive damage, leading some persons to make a one-to-one connection there. And so I'm thankful that N.T. Wright, following a heretical bishop, is himself orthodox on the issue of the resurrection. There's no doubt about that. In fact, N.T. Wright has written one of the most magisterial and important defenses of the resurrection of Christ in all of contemporary theology. So on the one hand, I'm very thankful. But I find a real problem in this interview and in other things that Dr. Wright has said about those who deny the bodily resurrection of Christ. What he says here is that Marcus Borg, and by the way, he and Marcus Borg co-wrote a book on Christ, one defender of the historicity, the biblical accounts, the virgin birth and the resurrection, that being Bishop Wright. and the other being a denier of those things. So in other words, Marcus Borg is well known as a liberal figure, very much involved with the Jesus Seminar when it was operational, who doesn't believe in all these historical occurrences concerning Christ, doesn't believe in a virgin birth or a virgin conception, doesn't believe in the bodily resurrection, doesn't believe really that Jesus was a divine human character. He says explicitly that he doesn't think that Jesus thought himself to be divine. So we're not just talking about the resurrection as if you could ever say just the resurrection. We're talking about the whole comprehensive truth claim concerning Christ. And yet when I hear Bishop Wright say that that Marcus Borg really does not believe Jesus was bodily raised from the dead, and then goes on to say, but I believe that he believes in Jesus, he loves Jesus and believes in him passionately, and he doesn't want to say that he's not a Christian, I have to come back and say, what meaning could this possibly have? You know, Paul in Romans chapter 10 says that salvation comes to those who confess with their lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in their hearts that God raised him from the dead. The Apostle Paul also in 1 Corinthians 15 said, if Christ is not raised from the dead, then we are of all persons most to be pitied because we have believed in vain. You know, we need to face the facts here. And this is one of our most difficult challenges in this postmodern age. We've got to really isolate the choices here. Either we believe in a Jesus who was fully God and fully man, born of a virgin and raised by the power of God, or we believe in a Jesus who was and is dead. Those are the only two logical options. And when you put it that way, here's the question. Can one be a Christian and believe that Jesus died in his crucifixion and is still in that tomb? I think the New Testament comprehensively eliminates that possibility. I think belief in the resurrection is the sum and substance of the gospel, as the not only the foundation of what we believe and our hope in Christ, but as an essential. I think Bishop Wright is correct when he says that churches that lose their grip on the bodily resurrection are in deep trouble, and that for healthy Christian life, individually and corporately, belief in the bodily resurrection is foundational. I agree with that emphatically. I just think it does not go far enough. It's not enough to say that belief in the resurrection is foundational. We have to go beyond that and say that belief in the resurrection is essential, because I think that is the very sum and substance of the apostolic preaching of the gospel. And, you know, so when we're talking about these kinds of questions, we understand there are all kinds of conflicting interests, aren't there? I mean, we don't want to hurt people's feelings. We don't want to mischaracterize what persons have said. But when someone like Marcus Borg is so clear and emphatic, repeatedly putting such things not only in his spoken form, but in print, we have to deal with the ramifications of what he really means here. Speaking of Easter, there are other things out there that we just need to know. Sometimes it's not skeptics that do the damage. Sometimes it's persons from within the church. And it'd be easy not to talk about this, but I'm just going to mention that Dr. David Nelson of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, wrote an article that really caught my eye about how persons in the church, sometimes well-intended and well-meaning, do grave damage to the gospel by misrepresenting the truth of God's word. As Dr. Nelson makes very clear, the gospel is foolishness to Greeks. That's what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1. It's foolishness in the eyes of many who simply cannot understand the logic of salvation through a Savior who died on the cross and was raised by the power of God. But that's the foolishness we have to bear. We have to be very careful that we're not foolish in other ways. He talks about a church near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that put on an Easter program last year in which the Easter bunny was whipped in an attempt to show how Jesus was crucified. He went on to say the show attracted not only the ire of several parents who attended with their children, but also the attention of national media. The youth minister at the church said this, quote, the program was for all ages, not just kids. We wanted to convey what that Easter is not just about the Easter bunny. It's about Jesus Christ. Dr. Nelson says this, whatever the intentions of the church, and it seems they were good, this all comes off as so much, well, foolishness. But it is foolishness of the wrong kind. Now we have the world objecting not to the foolishness of the cross, but clamoring about the foolishness of the church. You know, this leads me to make a clarification that I would think would be unnecessary. But hey, in the week after what the world calls Easter, let's talk about this. The Easter bunny is not a Christian character. You will not find the Easter bunny in the New Testament, nor will you find the Easter bunny in Christian tradition. That is a cultural creation. And it's now used more or less as a cute little merchandising device by those who would sell Easter as a cultural holiday. There is no Easter bunny in the Bible, okay? So let's have nothing of this where someone's flogging the Easter bunny trying to make a point about the passion and the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I'm with Dr. Nelson on this one. Let's make sure that the foolishness we bear is the foolishness of the cross, not some foolishness we conjure up on our own. Richard Garnett, professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, has written some pretty wise words in USA Today. And he's talking about politics in the church. He says this: for starters, and with all due respect to Thomas Jefferson, the First Amendment does not constrain. In fact, it protects political preaching and faith-based activism. Now, what Mr. Garnett is trying to show here is that when persons have deep beliefs, they have to come out somehow in terms of public philosophy. He says here that our supposedly private religious beliefs always make claims that push the believer inexorably toward charitable and conscientious engagement in public life. I think Mr. Garnett's onto something here. We all know there's a problem when people turn their pulpits into political platforms. The pulpit is to center in the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's why we were just talking about the centrality of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. But the truth claim that Christianity makes, unavoidably, has some political dimension to it. At some point we have to say, we believe this is right and that's wrong. It's political to say, Jesus Christ is Lord and not Caesar. We'll be right back. This is the Albert Mueller Program. I mentioned this article by Christopher Orr in the New Republic today. It has to do with Brokeback Mountain and its cultural meaning. The title of his article is Masculinity in Brokeback Mountain. There's a link to it in my article about his article, published at www.albertmoeller.com. Mr. Orr argues that the furor over the movie has to do with the fact that our current cultural context no longer allows two men to be living together without someone, or virtually everyone, assuming them to be homosexual. He laments the disappearance of what he calls the cowboy as archetype of male relationships. Now, in so doing, he looks at the relationship of the two central characters in Brokeback Mountain, and he says it was in the shape of a marriage. And yet, looking back to Larry McMurtry's 1985 novel Lonesome Dove, he argues that the same thing was basically true of the two characters in that novel, later made into a movie, the characters Woodrow Call and Augustus McCrae. McMurtry also, importantly, wrote the screenplay adaptation of Annie Proulx's short story, Brokeback Mountain, for the movie. And so here you have Christopher Orr saying, look, Mr. McMurtry wrote two different stories, basically, about two different sets of two cowboys. And in the first one, and I believe it was Tommy Lee Jones and Robert Duvall who starred in that first movie, in the first one, no one assumed that these two men were homosexuals, even though they ran a ranch together, they lived together over a long period of time, they were clearly good friends, and there's no woman in the picture. No one assumed they were homosexual. But now you fast forward 20 years from 1985 to 2005, you translate from Lonesome Dove to Brokeback Mountain, and the storyline is that the two guys, Jake and Ennis in this story, are homosexual. Now, here's where Mr. Orr, I think, goes off the track. Listen to his text here. He says, anyone familiar with the 1985 novel will have no trouble recognizing the similarities between Ennis and Jack on the one hand and Call and Agnes McRae, his partner, on the other. In both cases, it's a pairing of opposites, the laconic and the loquacious, the abstemious with the openly pleasure-seeking, the masculine with the relatively feminine. It's tempting to suggest that McMurtry and Osana, that is of the movie, subvert these characters in Brokeback Mountain by making them gay, but sexuality seems largely beside the point. Call and McRae, that's of Lonesome Dove, were after all life partners. Does it really make so much difference whether they were sleeping together? Homoerotic tension has, in any case, been part and parcel of the Western cattle drive, at least since Montgomery Clift and John Ireland. And what he goes on to say is that the difference between the two characters in Lonesome Dove and the two characters in Brokeback Mountain, quote, isn't about the appearance of homosexuality, but the disappearance of homeosociability, end quote. Now, what I want to zero in on today is his question, does it really matter that they were sleeping together? Because I think in raising the question, Mr. Orr completely misses the point. And let me tell you what I think the point is. I think the point is this, that men had the ability, before the normalization of homosexuality, to establish close friendships, to be very close together, to be on a cattle drive or in a ranch or whatever else, without anyone assuming that it is homosexual. And when you look at it that way, it is one of those situations in which now the situation has changed. And the situation has changed so that persons now argue that that it's repression of homosexuality that is the only inhibiting factor here. that it shouldn't matter. I think it does matter whether the Cowboys are sleeping together. I think everybody does know it matter. I think everyone would have seen the movie Lonesome Dove and that novel differently if they'd understood that Call and McRae were sleeping together. But they weren't. And because they weren't, and because society had norms and expectations that they weren't, then they could be recognized as being friends without anyone assuming they were homosexual. Now, you may remember that Anthony Eastland wrote an article on the end of friendship that I cited on this program and we talked about some time back, in which he makes the same point, but I think he gets the point right. He goes on to say, look, the normalization of homosexuality makes it virtually impossible for young men to pair off together in friendships without people assuming they're homosexual. Because if it is just okay, just a lifestyle option, just another alternative lifestyle to sleep together, then people will assume that they are. You know, I had a youth minister in a local church tell me that he took a group of high school boys on a retreat, and when they found out that they were going to have to change clothes to go swimming in the same common area, they erupted with protest. And he said, for the first time, I realized that the way homosexuality has been forced in the culture has now made these kids, these teenagers, scared to be in the presence of other boys because the expectation of homosexuality is just there. It's been put there by the society. It's put there by the culture. The normal ease with which men used to relate to one another is gone because now everything is potentially sexually charged. You know, there are barriers between the way that men and women can relate to each other. And without it being understood as sexual. You know, if someone came up to my wife and acted in a romantic way towards her, even in a physical gesture or something, I would be very much offended and alarmed, and I would be stepping into the situation because I would know what those gestures mean. Well, Anthony Eastland says, look, what we have done is to allow the eroticization of normal relationships between young males, boys, teenagers, young men, and now if they show the slightest affection for one another, people assume they're gay. Now, Christopher Orr has a point. He's onto something. He's looking back, as many people are now, trying to figure out the meaning of Brokeback Mountain. And he says, I think the meaning is that that we have destroyed homosociability. And he implies that it's really a problem among us in that we're just continually hung up about sexuality. And he says, does it make a difference that they sleep together? I think it does. I think what he says or what he implies in raising that question is that he misses the point. If persons assume they are sleeping together, they're going to deal with them differently than if they assume that they are not. And when in society the assumption that they are not is removed by the normalization of homosexuality, then that just puts on an entire layer of sexual complication to every male friendship. I mean, right now, let's be serious. Once you've talked about Brokeback Mountain and you know about that story, when you go back and watch those cowboy movies of old, the old spaghetti westerns and all the rest, well, there's a lot of things that you couldn't do in those movies today that were done then because now people are going to read them as meaning something no one would have assumed them to mean in the 1960s or the 1970s. It's changed the way we look at movies. It's changed the way we look at cowboys. It's changed the way we look at camping trips and everything else. And I think it's because when a society begins to break down its sexual code, and when it begins to normalize homosexuality, you run into a big problem here, because then everything becomes sexualized, or potentially so, and if you no longer assume that two men living together aren't having sex, then guess what? You begin to assume that they are. And I think it's just patent nonsense to say that it doesn't make any difference. I think we all know it makes difference. I think, frankly, that homosexual couples would say it makes difference. And I think those who believe that homosexuality should not be normalized also recognize, of course, it makes a difference. Does it make a difference to you? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Here's the question. Has our society, now in its embrace of the sexual revolution, not made it that much more difficult for young men to establish relationships, or young women for that matter? But especially here looking at young men, I think we've changed the terrain so much that young men are getting the message and they're pulling back. And the kind of normal male friendships that have been at the very center of our civilization throughout history are now becoming more and more complicated. You know, things are read differently. Gestures are read differently. Words and emotions are read differently. I think it's one symptom of what happens when you begin to break down the sexual code. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program.
Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of our purposes in this program is to try to look at the underlying issues, the principles that are involved, the worldview implications of cultural developments, issues in the news, and all the rest. I think this article published in the New Republic today is a signal event in this way. I think when it begins to point to Brokeback Mountain and to explain from one of the major magazines in our culture-shaping empire here, what the meaning of Brokeback Mountain is, we need to pay attention. And when he comes back and he says it's about the death of homosociability rather than homosexuality, he's making the argument that that we have allowed homophobia, and he does not use that word, but you know, homophobia to so corrupt the way we look at things that our concern about whether these cowboys are having sex is the problem. It kind of haunts the conscience of America and creates a repressive environment in which men aren't free to establish relationships and close partnerships and friendships, whether they are having sex with each other or not. Well, I'm coming back to say that the whether they're having sex together or not is exactly the issue, because I don't think any of us can fool ourselves into believing that it doesn't make a difference. That's what Mr. Orr says explicitly. It shouldn't make a difference. It does make a difference. And I think the difference between Lonesome Dove in 1985 and the Brokeback Mountain movie in 2005, both of the film adaptations written by Larry McMurtry, I think what you have there is a reminder that in 20 years, something massive has changed in this culture. And I'm going to argue further that what has changed in this sexual revolution is even the ability to establish male friendships. Anthony Eastland, I've cited from his article, A Requiem for Friendship. The subtitle of his article is Why Boys Will Not Be Boys and Other Consequences of the Sexual Revolution. This is what he says, quote, for modern American men, friendship is no longer forged in the heat of battle or in the dust of the plains as they drive their herds across half a continent or in the choking air of a coal mine or even in the cigar smoke of a debating club. He goes on and says, the sexual revolution has also nearly killed male friendship as devoted to anything beyond drinking and watching sports. And the homosexual movement, a logically inevitable result of 40 years of heterosexual promiscuity and feminist folly, bids fair to finish it off and nail the coffin shut. You see, once we could assume that men were not having sex with each other, they were then freed to establish friendships. But if every male relationship now holds open the possibility of sex, well, then everything is off in terms of the old rules about male friendships, and a lot of guys are just saying, I won't establish any. We're going to pull back. That's not going to happen. I think it's a good topic for us to discuss. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to George, listening on XM170, calling from Lovington, New Mexico. Go ahead, George.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. I live in an area of cowboys and have experience the friendships of these men, and the connotation that the film puts on any male relationship basically is fictitious, and there, I don't think it should or does actually have that much, especially in the cowboy field. It really doesn't have that kind of effect on a cowboy and a man. They already know who they are. Now, boys, it could affect them, but I believe that the family orientation, the church orientation, regardless of the public opinions, is still the strongest point, and they do have the strength and the wherewithal to to stand up to any criticism that is placed on them by Hollywood or the news media.
Yeah, you know, I think there are some for whom that's definitely true, George. I think the difficulty is how the society reads the whole thing. Let me just give you two examples. Let's say that, let's get away from cowboys for a moment, and let's just make it soldiers. Think of the movie Saving Private Ryan, or go back to, you know, The Longest Day, or The Sands of Iwo Jima, those great military movies. And there you had soldiers who were fighting together. And in the context of that battle, they established deep and almost unbelievable friendships. Literally, their lives depend upon each other. And yet, there's a clear expectation that there's no sexual dimension to that. No sexual activity implied in that. No sexual relationship that is expected to emerge from that. And thus, they are free to establish those relationships. But you throw in the possibility of sex, and I think it changes the dynamic of the whole relationship. I think it changes what's going on in terms of their expectations of marriage, their expectations of child rearing and child bearing, their expectations of a man's role in society and all the rest. I think it just changes everything. And I think those who fool themselves into thinking that the sexual revolution won't change every other dimension of life really aren't getting it. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, most of the discussion about Brokeback Mountain, back when it was certainly in the lead-up to the Oscars and all the rest, was about whether or not America was really going to celebrate this movie that was celebrating a homosexual pair of cowboys and all the rest. And most Americans dealt with it at such a surface level, just very superficially. I like it. I don't like it. I'm for this. I'm against that. I hope it gets the Academy Award for Best Picture. I hope it doesn't. That's where so much of the debate was. And in the mainstream media, clearly, there was a very pro-Brokeback Mountain tilt. There was just no question about that. Of course, the movie did not get the Best Picture Award. That went instead to Crash. And after that, the movie and the news story kind of went into the background. There hasn't been so much discussion lately. I think it's probably healthy that there are some people now trying to go back and say, what was the meaning of all of this? Now, I wrote an article on this back last year in anticipation of the movie because I agree with Anthony Eselin that what this really represents is what happens when the sexual revolution in general and the acceptance of homosexuality in particular begins to affect the way that men relate to each other. And I meant seriously what I said earlier. Once you think Brokeback Mountain, it's difficult to go back and watch the spaghetti westerns, the great westerns of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, without seeing things that you now kind of see in a completely different light. You're kind of sometimes even embarrassed to have these thoughts all of a sudden come up. Sometimes you kind of find yourself snickering or sniggling at some of this because you realize, boy, Clint Eastwood and some of these other people in these spaghetti westerns, they couldn't say and do some of the things now they did then without people reading those actions and words now in a very, very different way. I think this affects the way young men in particular think about male friendships. I think the guys that fought together in World War II figured it out. I think even the guys that fought together in Vietnam figured it out. I think a lot of the guys out there on the plains who even now are working as cowboys, having to work together and all the rest, I think they figured it out. But I think it's left a generation trying to figure all this out, finding themselves in a great deal of difficulty. If they do this, if they establish this friendship, if the two boys go on a camping trip together, if these two guys, share an apartment after college, what does this imply? There are a lot of people who are raising these issues anew. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Peoria, Arizona, where David's on the line. Go ahead, David.
Yes, Dr. Marl, I think you're absolutely accurate with what you're saying. I think it does make it hard. It makes it really hard for what other people see and what people say also when they look at men together, and I think it makes it hard to make a relationship. I grew up as a cowboy, not a sheep herder. I don't know much about them, but living in Arizona, I've never seen that kind of action myself. And one of the things we have to remember is these guys were not only having an affair with each other, but they were also having affairs on their wives.
Well, that's exactly right. They were cheating on their wives. Now, of course, David, hang here with me if you can. I think the message of the movie and of the short story was clearly that was simply because of the societal homophobia, they would call it, that led these men to try to act heterosexual when they were actually homosexual. I want to go back to the question that Christopher Orr raises in his article. He said, does it really make any difference whether they, that is Jake and Ennis in Brokeback Mountain, or the two characters in Lonesome Dove, were having sex together, or he says were sleeping together? I think it does, and it sounds to me like you think it does too.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's what they were doing. That was absolutely wrong. You know, I worked overseas in the Philippines, and you'd see oftentimes men over there would walk with their arm around each other, and it was no big deal. That's the way they are there. You wouldn't do that here.
No, you wouldn't do it now, that's for sure. And, you know, I go back to what I just said, David. I've watched some of those old Westerns. I love them. You know, I've got the complete collection of all those Clint Eastwood movies. Morricone soundtracks and all the rest are just fantastic. You know, Hang 'Em High, you know, all those great movies that come from that era. And, you know, you look at them now, after all the debate over Brokeback Mountain, and they don't look the same. You know, simply because those movies represent a world that after Brokeback Mountain just doesn't exist in the same way, a world that is uncomplicated by this very issue of sexuality. David, I really do appreciate your call. It's good to hear from Peoria, Arizona, and from someone who was a cowboy as well. And David's exactly right. This is also, almost accidentally, I think, I don't think Annie Prue or Larry McMurtry intended for their movie perhaps to be so clear about the damage this did to all involved, including the women against whom they were sinning as they were involved in this. And Mr. Orr describes the fishing trips they took in which no line ever hit the water. Because by the time you see the movie or read the short story, you know exactly what's going on there. You know, I think those are really, really important issues. And for you to join the conversation, all you have to do is call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Joe Dallas, writing in the Creation Research Journal, makes some very similar points here. This is Mr. Dallas writing about Brokeback Mountain. He says, the film is a sermon, to be sure, and the message is clear. If only society could have abandoned its prejudice against gays, these fine men openly could have lived a long and happy life together. It's a message we've heard before, but not against the backdrop of such breathtaking scenery, earnest storytelling, and performances by rugged, handsome men mixing homosexuality with America's classic masculine icon, the cowboy. Christians should expect friends and co-workers who have seen the film to say, they were such nice guys who really loved each other. So what's your problem with that? I think Joe Dallas asked one of those questions that we ought to ask, and that is, you know, what's the problem with that? We better be ready to give an answer. And when others come back and say, does it matter that they're sleeping together? We better be ready with an answer. Let's go to Kay calling from Tallahassee, Florida, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Kay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think the crux of this is that we as Christians need to be able to help our young brothers and young sisters develop very early the relationship with Christ and know who they are in Christ. I grew up it took me 30 years to figure out who I was in Christ. And I have a brother who's lived a homosexual lifestyle for years, and he's never figured out who he is in Christ. And I think these young men and young women, once they know that, that's the most important relationship that they could ever establish. And that love of Christ is going to help them establish healthy relationships throughout their whole entire life.
Okay. I can only emphatically agree with what you say there, because when we do establish our relationship in Christ and with Christ, then we also see how that Christ makes a claim as Lord of our lives upon every dimension of our being, every relationship and every friendship we have, every thought, word, or deed that we contemplate. And with that as background, then the way we would look at any friendship or any relationship means that we would have to do so in light of His Lordship and the right of our Creator, as revealed in His Word, to set down how we are and are not to make such arrangements, with whom we are and are not to establish such relationships. And, of course, this brings into this the fact that the Bible speaks so clearly of an ought, a do and a don't. And that's what so many in this society just don't want. I'll be right back in just a moment. This is Albert Mohler. Has Brokeback Mountain changed the way we look at male friendships? The question raised anew in today's edition online of The New Republic, also later to appear in the magazine. The article's by Christopher Orr. I find his article interesting, but I can't agree with his premise. He says it really shouldn't matter whether these cowboys are having sex with one another, whether they're sleeping together, because that's just a kind of an imposition on the story. It shouldn't matter. I argue that it does. And the very fact that it does explains, well, first of all, why we're even talking about this, why the movie's interesting to many people in this culture, and why I think male friendships have become so complicated after the sexual revolution. Let's go to Mike, listening on XM170, calling from Bristol, Virginia. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, now. Thanks for taking my call. My point was, yeah, I mean, you're right on track. It's just, nowadays, I'm a truck driver and going down the road. Used to, you'd see two guys going down the road, you'd never think nothing about it. But now, when you see two guys going down the road, you know, you just think that they're gay, or you know,
or you think that they might be. I mean, see, that's the thought that enters your mind, Mike. And I agree with you. It's one of those things where you all of a sudden realize you just don't know. And, you know, I just think what we've lost here is precious to us. It's something very important to civilization. And it's something that gets undermined the moment we begin to say, look, sexual anarchy can be embraced. And as a culture, we'll just deny all the sexual norms, the normativity of heterosexual marriage, the cultural judgment, the moral judgment that homosexual behavior is wrong. When we let go of all of that and everything's turned just into an alternative lifestyle or a sexual choice or a sexual orientation, then what's left is that everything is potentially sexual. And it's no longer just the gender issue, male and female, heterosexual and homosexual. Now there's a lot more than that. I mean, just look at the flood of articles that have appeared in major mainstream media sources over the last several weeks on polyamory and polygamy. I mean, there's a tidal wave of all of this. And now you have other people coming back and saying, recently, maybe we need to renegotiate the age of consent. Because after all, if it really is just a matter of expressing oneself and all the rest, then teenagers ought to be able to do this. This has been in the courts this week. And you start looking at this and you realize this is a society that is embracing a sexual anarchy in its very core that that eventually could make society, culture, civilization almost impossible. Because we have to have certain boundaries and certain institutions and certain mechanisms of trust. I have to be able to trust that this man's interest in my son is not sexual, that this woman's interest in my son is not sexual. I mean, you don't think this has to do with the stuff happening between school teachers and kids and all the rest? Anarchy means anarchy, folks, and order means order. The question is, who sets the order and by what rules? I'll be back tomorrow to join you. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.